Welcome to another exciting episode of the Business of Digital podcast, featuring your hosts, Matt Siltala and Dave Rohr. Hey guys, excited to have everybody join us on another one of these Business of Digital podcast episodes, and we got a special treat for everyone today. And I'm just going to jump right into it because I don't want to waste any time, but we got Elmer Bouton to thank for helping us get this set up. But Dave and I, we have Maureen Olhausen, the former FTC commissioner and acting chairman, joining us to talk about all the fun stuff with FTC and all those other F-related words and whatnot. So Maureen, welcome, and thank you for being on the show.
Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be here to talk about digital issues, antitrust, consumer protection, all the things that are in the headlines these days.
Awesome. And we look forward to jumping right into it. But if you want to, feel free to go ahead and just kind of give our listeners a little bit more of a background. Not that what I stated doesn't speak for itself, but maybe give them a little bit more background as to what you're doing now and anything else before we really jump into this and start kicking it off.
Absolutely. Happy to do this. So when I was at the Federal Trade Commission, that's an agency that has two main missions. The first one is to promote competition, does antitrust enforcement, and the second one is to protect consumers. So it ended up being the agency that did a lot of the privacy work, particularly we've done it for, the agency did it for years, but in the online space became kind of the online privacy enforcer for the U.S. My term ended last September. I had a wonderful 6.5 years there the agency. Thank you. Yeah, across 10 different commissioners, 3 different congresses. I've seen a lot.
Yes, I can imagine.
And now I'm in private practice. I am the chair of the antitrust group at Baker Botts. We're an international law firm. And I am a co-chair of the competition antitrust group. But I'm focusing on the intersection of antitrust and other areas like privacy and data security and intellectual property, because all these disciplines are really coming together as we're having so much convergence in our economy, mainly driven by online business.
Excellent. Well, that's a perfect segue into the opening question. But before I jump into it, I just also want to give a virtual wave to Dave and Elmer. I know that they're on. And hey, guys,
you're muted.
And I know that, yes, here and muted and just ready to listen and learn. But hi, guys. How are you guys doing today?
Well, thanks, Matt. I'm doing very well. And I'm really excited to hear this. This is a great follow up to our last conversation with my friend Steve Cernak. And Maureen will have a lot more interesting things to talk about.
Yeah, the last 6 years has to have been just incredible for that. And so I'm just going to jump into it, Maureen. And can you explain the scope of where the FTC does get involved and where it doesn't at a high level? And I guess to maybe clarify that, what as business owners and marketers, we often hear, quote unquote, the government or the FTC or the FCC or FBI, FDA, whatever F word and whatnot. And so maybe can you talk to that and the scope of where the FTC in particular does get involved and where it doesn't at a high level?
So the FTC has a very general authority over unfair and deceptive acts or practices in commerce and unfair methods of competition. So Congress, a little over 100 years ago, gave the FTC this broad suite of authorities. But the FTC doesn't have authority over common carriers, so you wouldn't see the FTC taking action against airlines, railroads, or the old phone system. But in the new, kind of in our new economy, the FTC plays a very important role in the online space. So looks at mergers of big companies, mergers that may impact competition across a whole range of industries. So I mentioned online, pharmaceuticals, healthcare, industrial products of all kinds. The FTC may be overseeing a merger or a conduct investigation there. But one of the things that where the FTC's gotten a lot of attention really since the advent of the online, the consumer internet starting in the late 90s, is in for the online space. So fraud and advertising, all those kinds of issues, but really privacy. Privacy has become such a big issue for consumers, and the FTC is the privacy enforcer for the U.S. in most areas. So you've got health information, right? Congress has carved that out and given that role to HHS to oversee under HIPAA. You might have financial information, banking information, and that you might see enforced in another, you know, from another agency, but everything else falls under the FTC's purview. And so it's been quite an active online privacy and data security enforcer using this very general authority that Congress has given it. The agency has a little bit of specialized authority under the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, where Congress set out particular rules and gave the FTC some additional authority there. But generally, the FTC is using this unfair and deceptive acts or practices authority to enforce privacy and data security obligations throughout the economy.
So that's interesting. That's a segue, and I'm going to kind of skip. We have like a, you know, we talked about a list of questions, but that gives me a perfect opportunity to kind of jump into this data privacy area. You know, the EU has the GDPR, California has the CCPA, and the US has, question mark. do you see something between the GDPR and the CCPA coming at all to the US, or is this kind of what you're saying we have, or what are your thoughts on that? And Dave or Elmer, feel free to jump in on any of this as well.
So let me take that question in two parts, and feel free to jump in with additional questions or if you want clarification. So I mentioned the FTC's unfair and deceptive acts and practices authority, and the agency has taken over 250 privacy enforcement actions based, privacy and data security actions based on that general authority. So we think about the Equifax data breach. The FTC brought an action there. The Ashley Madison case, lots of enforcement for privacy violations. And it uses its authority in two ways. One, if there was a promise that data would be used or secured or shared or not shared in certain ways and a company didn't keep that promise, then the FTC could bring an enforcement action. Or if a company engaged in unreasonable practices, this is typically in the data security space, didn't secure the data appropriately and that caused harm to consumers, then the FTC could bring an enforcement action. And as I mentioned, a lot of the data security cases, the big data security cases you've heard about, where the FTC's brought enforcement actions, it's been under using that authority. But there's, you know, obviously been a lot of concerns about whether the tools that the FTC has, the privacy and data security enforcement protections we have in the U.S. are robust enough. And there's been an important debate in Congress about whether we should have a federal law that is more specific to privacy. And I think there's some, you know, we've heard different bills being discussed in both the House and the Senate. And I do think it's a time where we could see some action from Congress. There's enough concerns that have brought a lot of different stakeholders to the table that previously weren't quite ready to come to an agreement. Some of it is from GDPR, right? So we've got that already in operation in Europe. CCPA is about to go into operation. There are concerns about, well, we have, you know, one of the great benefits we enjoy in the U.S. is in a lot of products, and particularly in the online area, a national market. And I think there are some concerns about creating some divisions now where you're going to have, you know, a certain privacy law for people in California or businesses in California that don't apply across the rest of the country. What does that mean for consumers? What does that mean for companies? And so Congress is starting to seriously discuss a national federal privacy law, likely would give the FTC some additional authority and some additional tools. I think the FTC's done a very good job. I always say it kind of punches above its weight. It's a small agency. It really doesn't have that big a budget. It has these two big jobs. And the agency itself has been asking for some additional tools in the privacy area. Whether Congress will actually get it across the finish line, you know, remains to be seen. But there's one way I put it in my long history in act of, you know, being an enforcer and a lawyer in this space, it's the closest I've ever seen to any kind of federal bill being passed.
It kind of makes sense, though, with you. Anyway, from just what I've been seeing, it almost seems like it's becoming the norm. You're expecting to hear some kind of news about some, what's the latest data breach this week? And so it's interesting. Dave, did you have a question?
Yeah, I think in Quebec has, you know, you have to speak French, which is completely different than privacy laws in one state and the other 49 having different, especially online. Amazon and different things for online taxing, it's a little bit easier, I think, but do you think the election might slow things down versus California trying to speed things up for the national kind of some sort of our own GDPR? Do you think those types of factors are going to play in as far as they're going to might try to get it in the next 1 or 2 years, or do you think it might be 3 to 5?
I think that there's a lot of interest in doing it in the nearer term rather than the longer term, though there are certainly cross currents that can, you know, speed things up or slow things down. California continues to change, right? So there, we've got the bill, the CCPA, but there were proposed regulations put out last week that didn't quite match up with people's expectations about what they would be. And now we have Mr. McTaggart coming up possibly with a new initiative. So as that continues to, you know, even California isn't, you know, kind of set in stone. So I think that continues to raise the desire to get a uniform federal standard in place. But certainly, you know, Washington's a political town. Politics will impact whether and when anything can get done. So I don't make predictions about whether it will actually happen. I just say it's more likely than I've seen before, and more people are at this table asking for it.
Very interesting. Go ahead, Elmer, and jump in.
Well, that brings up some interesting points, because when we're looking at businesses that operate nationally, which most of the online businesses that the audience here supports, it becomes extremely complicated. If California passes a law and then Nevada passes a law, and let's just say Michigan and Illinois pass different laws, how are we going to be able to comply with all of these? It becomes really complicated. And when I'm looking at, you know, how this should play out, it makes sense that the something should be done at the federal level rather than having a patchwork of different regulations across 50 states potentially. Because that just seems like it would add a lot of expense and a lot of unnecessary administrative burden to businesses, which is not good for consumers in the long run.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think in some ways it would be ironic for the U.S. to start having a more fractured system, because one of the things that drove the adoption of the GDPR in Europe was a desire in Europe to have a more unified market there. The previous privacy data protection regulation allowed each nation who is a member of the European Union to adopt its own rule kind of to a certain standard, but that created a lot of differences. So GDPR was, you know, part of this idea that they want a single market, they need a single standard. I think that makes a lot of sense in the U.S. Some of people have concerns, well, the federal, you know, is the federal agency enough? Is it robust enough? What about the state AGs? What should their role be? And one of the things that I often point to is the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, which I mentioned earlier, which has a single federal standard and the federal government enforces it, but the state AGs can also enforce it, but at the same federal, like the standard that's set out in the federal law. So that's a way to kind of get both of those benefits, to have a uniform standard, but also to allow enforcement, say there's something that is more local and wouldn't necessarily, you know, the federal agency can only do so much, would allow a state AG to enforce, but again, keep that uniformity that's so beneficial for having a national market.
And that seems like a very good model. I mean, if we look at it even from a constitutional perspective, you know, most online businesses are interstate just by their very nature. So regulating interstate commerce is one of those things that is the certainly within the purview of the federal government, and then allowing for state and even local enforcement of those laws makes a lot of sense because, as you rightly pointed out, if your agency is small and has limited powers to pursue issues, it helps that the states can participate in that as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm always a fan of looking at what has worked well in the past and learning from that, right? Kind of adapting that to the new, you know, whatever the new needs are, kind of learn from history of what's worked as, you know, again, kind of use that as a framework on which to build.
Well, let's, I want to just take advantage of the time that we have with you, Maureen. And so I want to kind of jump into a little bit of tech and antitrust stuff. And so other countries, they do have antitrust or competition laws that are similar to, but not identical to the laws here in the U.S. And so how does that coordination among different countries work, and what does it mean for big tech companies?
We in the U.S. have, you know, our antitrust laws. And as business has become more global, it's required more coordination. Well, you hope there would be coordination among other antitrust enforcers. One of the things we share with Europe, and I hope we will continue to share with Europe, is the focus on antitrust being a tool to promote consumer interests, not to promote local industrial interests or to promote one type of business over another type of business. That, you know, we favor, you know, one set of businesses over another set. We should, for antitrust, always be considering what consumer interests are, which is generally called the consumer welfare standard. And we've typically shared that with the Europeans and a lot of other agencies, the Canadians, who actually had an antitrust law before the U.S. did, so kudos to Canada. But that should be the appropriate focus of an antitrust analysis, not saying, does it hurt an American business and help, you know, a business from another part of the world, and that antitrust should take that into account. But once you get away from some of those commonalities about consumer interests and, looking at market impacts, Europe does have a slightly different approach called the abuse of dominance standard. And the abuse of dominance standard, in my view, really grew out of European history, where they had state-owned enterprises that we really never had here in the U.S. And so some of the companies that had a big market share just inherited that because they were the state-owned enterprise who then got privatized. And so some of their antitrust law really developed around, you know, as a reaction to that. And again, in the U.S., we didn't have that. So we have a slightly different standard about what are the obligations on a large player in a market that already has, you know, a large share to deal with rivals in the marketplace. And so I think that explains some of the different outcomes we've seen, and the facts are different too, the local market conditions in the U.S. and Europe involving some of the big online players. Things are changing in the U.S., however, at least some of the attention is changing. I don't know if it will change actual outcomes because the U.S. law, you know, is what the courts have interpreted it to be, but there is an increasing attention in the U.S. on some of the big online players, and has the antitrust law, you know, played out, enforcement and scrutiny? Should there be more than there has been?
Very good, Dave. Did you want? I just want to make sure that you got that question answered, or you didn't have any follow up as far as antitrust and tech goes, and Did you have anything, Dave or Elmer, to add to that?
So I was thinking about this earlier this morning as I was considering getting ready to talk with you, Maureen. And one of the interesting things that occurred to me was how nice it is for the consumer to be able to adapt one specific digital ecosystem over another. So for example, I prefer Apple hardware. I like iOS for my tablets and my phones, but I am definitely 2 feet in the Google universe as far as some other things go, like I have a digital assistant. I have my plugs all running off of that. I have a Google Home in my house. You know, I have all these different gadgets, and it's easier for me, you know, that my wife and I are both sharing this Google ecosystem. And I'm sure those who fall into Apple's or Amazon's, it's the same way. But when we're looking at this from the consumer perspective, you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, Google's too big, or Amazon's too big, or Apple is too big, and they're abusing their power. But from my perspective, it seems like it's more advantageous for consumers from that perspective. So, you know, given your professional knowledge and experience, how do you see that playing out over the next several years?
There always has, there. If you kind of go back in tech history, and even pre, you know, big tech, I think there's always been this competing trends between kind of a closed ecosystem. I think Apple is a good example of that, where consumers, you know, if you read like the Steve Jobs biography, you know, his view about kind of controlling all of that for consumers and making a very seamless experience, versus having an ecosystem that's a lot more open, that allows others to interconnect more, but then also maybe has some messiness in some of the, you know, how things actually work. And so you see that, I think, in the difference between the Android operating system and the Apple operating system. You saw that between Apple and Microsoft, their approach to the desktop operating system.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a huge example, because my wife favors Android and I favor Apple. So the way we get together when we want to share things is through that common Google ecosystem.
Right. So I don't think antitrust should take a position on one being better than the other. It's really up to consumers. I think that there are, though, questions about, you know, every antitrust case is very fact specific. What is the impact of this behavior in this particular market? And then what is it over time? Like often, I find some of the current coverage of antitrust is looking at a snapshot, and they're looking at what we in the antitrust world would call static competition, kind of who's winning today and, you know, who's up, who's down, versus dynamic competition over time. If we set the rule in this way that says, well, this company has to share its assets with that company because that'll help that company be a better competitor, it doesn't necessarily take into account, well, what are the incentives that are created for that, for investment in the future? Will companies want to invest the same amount in innovation if then they're going to have to share it with their rivals down the road? And I think those are, you know, the kinds of questions we need to think very carefully about when we're doing antitrust enforcement in the tech space. And right now, as I said, I think there's a little too much of a snapshot picture without saying, you know, well, what has been the dynamic over time? Have we seen market share shifts? How has that happened? Where does competition really arise in these markets? One of the things I kind of joke about is we have the antitrust case of the century every 20 years, right? So you look back, we had the Intel case, IBM case, I mean, the IBM case. You know, we had the big AT&T breakup, but that was a little different because of the regulatory overlay there. We had the Microsoft case in the DC circuit. So I think, you know, we need to pay attention to the fact that we thought this company was, you know, going to be the dominant one forever, till something changed.
So
we need to allow those changes to occur.
Hold on. I'm going to jump in, Matt.
Okay.
Do you see, thinking of Microsoft, because I know I've heard that one thrown around, do you see any similarities, and I can't think of any, between Microsoft and the browser and them bundling, and how Google bundles all of their stuff? Like, could that get them in trouble, do you see? I'm just trying to look for ways that...
what's been said, yeah.
Well, what's been said, or what could past monopoly type, you know, antitrust things that have been brought up, does Google step on any or raise any flags like that? Can you think of any?
Well, I don't want to weigh in on the particular Google, you know. I don't have all the facts, so I don't want to dive into too much on a particular company. But I'll say that the Microsoft case did lay out some very important guideposts. It looked at, you know, because there were a lot of allegations that the government brought forth, and only a few got upheld on appeal by a unanimous per curiam D.C. Circuit. So they looked at some of the issue about interoperability and tying, and some of the problems that they determined, where there wasn't, you weren't competing on the merits, you weren't just trying to do a better product. You beat the other guy by having, you know, or the other woman or person, I should say, by the other competitor by having, you know, the fastest, best, cheapest, you know, what have you, but by making some decisions that actually didn't have any benefit in on the merits or in competition, you know, didn't. What it did was just make it much harder for that competitor to compete. So I think that's an important tool, an important screen in the Microsoft decision, that once you are a big player and you've got a very strong position in the marketplace, some of your decisions will be subject to a tighter antitrust screen, but it has to be focused on, you know, are you doing something that stops someone competing with you, but not by on the merits, not doing something better. And I think that's one of the challenges in antitrust today, is to say, is this company, you know, competing very vigorously by making a product that's better, faster, cheaper, you know, more innovative, or what have you? We need to be careful to make sure that that doesn't in itself become an antitrust violation. And I think the Microsoft case lays out a good, you know, kind of a good guidepost for that. And it's got this burden shifting kind of thing where you say, well, was it, you know, exclusionary? Did you, you know, do you have a big enough market share? And then you engage in something and conduct that excluded a competitor. And then, so first they have to show that. And then the burden is on the dominant player to say, why maybe that had a pro-competitive justification, why it was a good thing that they were doing. So having that burden shifting is, I think, a very good, as I said, kind of framework for antitrust analysis today to continue to look back to.
So thank you for that. Thank you for that. That was a great explanation. I do want to, for the last question here, and thank you so much again for your time. We really appreciate you being on the show. But I'm going to shift a little bit just because I think this would be really interesting for our specific audience, Dave and I. And you know,
I think Marine picked between this the two options. Speaking to the FTC and how they're dealing with influencers.
Yeah.
Or the fake reviews. That there's been some things that the FTC has kind of cracked down, and Elmer and all of us have seen, you know, Amazon, TripAdvisor, you know, any site you go to, there's fake reviews that Google's also fighting too.
Sure. I mean, I can, they really grow out of
really
the same.
Is it really
standard?
The same for your for
right,
the FTC?
So, right. So the idea is that if someone is making a claim, whether they're making a claim to be independent, like a lot of the influencer and the review enforcement has to do with when you're a consumer, and online reviews and influencers, you know, they've become very powerful forces in how consumers choose products. And but if they knew that the person who was giving that review or touting that product was being paid as really being a paid spokesperson for the company selling the product, I think they would look at it with a slightly more jaundiced eye. And that's what a lot of this enforcement is going towards. It's not saying for consumer, for influencers, you're not allowed to do that, but the consumers need to know that you're a paid spokesperson for that product. And similarly in the reviews, the FTC has done enforcement where they've reviews that are done by owners of the company, the owner's mother, employees of the company, and that they aren't disclosed. These aren't, arm's length third party kind of reviews. And so that's really what it all goes back to is, people have to have the understanding of, the fuller context to put that, whatever, influencers thing or online review into so they can understand how much weight to give it.
With all that, and speaking of weight, I'm just curious, your thoughts on in regard to that with the fake negative reviews. I would love to hear your thoughts on that and just kind of, maybe we'll just wrap it up with that one.
Sure. So, I think that goes back to the same thing, right? They're fake reviews. They're not, essentially commercial speech has a lot of protections, but false commercial speech is subject to, is not fully protected under the First Amendment. And consumers value these reviews. They're really important. And so it's important that they be truthful about who is actually offering this opinion and truthful in their content. Now, again, going back to the FTC, unfair and deceptive acts or practices in commerce, right? So if I'm doing this in commerce for pay, I'm a paid reviewer, that can be subject to it. Whereas, look, if my neighbor says to me, hey, I don't like this pizza place or I don't like that, and they're not being paid one way or the other to do it, that's not the type of enforcement the FTC is going to engage in, right? That's not commercial speech.
Yeah, it's just interesting because this is something that I know that myself, Elmer, and Dave have to fight on a daily basis for, our clients. There's always someone that's out there trying to put something fake and negative out there, and so this is a big issue. So I appreciate you weighing in on that.
Sure. No, it's look. There's a lot of speech issues. Or online speech issues are very, very hot these days. So it's
yes.
Very, very interesting.
Well, Maureen, we really appreciate your time, and we know that you're a very busy woman, and so we want to make sure that we are respectful of that, but. Maybe just kind of, I know that you have an event coming up next month if you want to talk about it and maybe mention that, and then we'll just, we'll go from there.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. These are such interesting and important issues, and I'm delighted I got a chance to talk about them today. And for people who are, interested in them, want to see what's happening, want to hear from the government, enforcers from all levels, and business and industry and technologists, the American Bar Association Antitrust Section is hosting a tech summit on November 18th. It's here in Washington, D.C. at the Ronald Reagan Center. It's an all-day program, and it's looking at these issues, privacy, antitrust, data security, platforms, intellectual property. Where is antitrust, going on these issues? What about privacy laws? We're going to have the head of the antitrust division. We're going to have the head of the Federal Trade Commission. Number of commissioners, other high-level people from the Department of Justice, state enforcers, talking about these issues in an all-day event. So I would definitely encourage anyone who's interested to come. As I said, it's November 18th. Register through the ABA Antitrust Section, and the early bird discount is ending soon. So act as soon as possible.
Awesome. And to all our listeners, this will be live, and we'll have a link for you. That you could click on in the write-up. So be sure and check that out. All right. Well, Maureen, thanks once again. We really appreciate these insights. We're so glad to have you on. Thank you, Elmer. And Dave, I don't know if you guys have any final thoughts, but if
nope,
you do,
thank
speak
you.
Now.
No,
nope,
this,
thank you.
This all is right. All quite fascinating. Thank you so much, Maureen and Dave and Matt. Really appreciate it.
Awesome. Well, for Maureen and Elmer and Dave, I'm Matt Sobola, and we thank you guys for having joined us, and look for the write-up, and we look forward to having you on another one of these. Bye, guys.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.